It made it through the Great Depression.
But one of America's oldest companies may not survive the Great Recession.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Today is Monday, December 13th. Coming up, President Obama tries to make nice with the business community. And inflation in China is on the rise. Why should that matter to Americans?
But first, it's officially called the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, and it's been around for 151 years. But today, the grocery store chain, more commonly known as A&P, is fighting to stay alive. The New Jersey-based company, which runs 395 grocery stores around the Northeast, has filed for bankruptcy. Marketplace's Janet Babin joins me now here in the New York studio to talk about it. Good morning, Janet.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So first of all, it's just amazing that we're talking about an A&P bankruptcy. This is a company that has survived through the ups and downs of about half of Americans' history.
Founded in 1859, that's pre-Civil War.
Wow.
A&P had its heyday back in the 30s, and back then it was the largest grocer in the country. It was the first national supermarket chain, and it even sponsored its own radio hour. It had singers like Kate Smith. I guess she was like the Katy Perry of her day. But then in the 70s, things started to sour in the 1970s. The company was sold to a German family, and now it's known under a bunch of different store names like Pathmark, Walbaum's, Food Emporium.
But that was even in the 70s. What's happening right now that's making it so difficult?
Well, the company blames its troubles on the downturn and on increased competition from the likes of Walmart and warehouse discounters. But there are those who think the economy had nothing to do with it. David Livingston is a supermarket research analyst. He's based in Milwaukee. And he told me this morning that A&P's been totally mismanaged.
The company just makes one mistake after another. One thing, they've got into a lot of real estate where they consistently pay above market rents. And everyone just scratches their heads like, why do they pay such high rents when no one else pays those kind of rents?
Now, Livingston says the company does have prime locations that other supermarkets are likely to buy up if they can.
All right. Marketplace's Janet Babin here in New York. Thanks.
Thank you.
The Senate is expected to vote today on President Obama's tax cut compromise. Included in that $861 billion tax and spending deal is about $3 billion in cash grants for renewable energy. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports from the Sustainability Desk on one big-name company in line for that money.
These Treasury Department cash grants are aimed at propping up large-scale solar and wind energy projects. That's why General Electric has been pushing hard for them. Morningstar analyst Daniel Holland.
If you see any of those big wind turbines that are out in the middle of a empty field, GE manufactures those, and you know has a pretty big vested interest in making sure that the renewable energy is successful.
But GE doesn't just make and sell wind turbines. It bets heavily on clean energy through its financial services unit, too. So far, the company's invested $6 billion in green energy projects around the world. That includes 95 wind farms and 40 solar installations. GE says it's invested in a half dozen projects that wouldn't have gotten off the ground without the Fed's renewable energy grants. The program is due to expire this month, but the Senate tax bill would extend it one more year. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And while we're on the subject of GE, the company announced today it's going to buy British oil drilling pipe maker Wellstream for $1.3 billion.
Well, Larry Summers makes his last speech today as director of President Obama's National Economic Council. There's speculation the president will name a replacement for Summers who can smooth over strained relations with the business community. On that note, the president will meet with a bunch of CEOs on Wednesday. Our Washington bureau chief John Dimsdale reports now on the White House's efforts to make nice with the private sector.
Last week, President Obama got behind a tax code overhaul that could benefit corporations. Martin Regalia is chief economist at the Chamber of Commerce. He says tax reform is a good idea, and thanks to Republican victories in Congress, business now has a seat at the White House negotiating table.
Where you have divided government, you actually can come to a table and discuss without having the feeling that you're going to be served as the main course.
The last successful tax reform was in 1986, when President Ronald Reagan was closer to the business community than Obama is. George Yin, who was a Senate staffer at the time, says that means Obama's tax reform faces strong headwinds.
that strategy becomes that much more difficult, it seems, because President Obama then has to go against the very sector that he already doesn't have very good relations with.
Still, Yin says tax reform gives the White House a chance to repair its standing with the business community. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The rating agency Moody's said this morning that the tax package that gets a vote today in the Senate could eventually lead to a downgrade of the AAA rating on U.S. debt.
That could make it more difficult for the U.S. to borrow money. Let's get some analysis now with Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Good morning.
Good morning.
So Moody's obviously doesn't think the deal's positive effects on growth will outweigh its negative effects on the deficit. But a lot of people are starting to call this tax cut deal a stimulus package. What's your take?
Well, I think it's not mainly a stimulus package. Keep in mind that the extension of the Bush tax cuts are just a postponement of a tax hike. It's not real stimulus. So it's not something that's going to boost growth terribly. My overall estimate is that we're only going to get about a quarter to maybe half a percentage point on growth from the package. That's coming from the payroll tax cut and the extension of unemployment benefits. Even a lot of that is going to get saved. Middle and high earners are still trying to restore their saving. And even low earners are going to face higher food and energy prices, which are going to sap some of the strength of the package.
All right, Julia, also this week, the president is meeting with corporate CEOs. He's trying to make nice with the business community. How much of an uphill battle does he have on that front?
It's a pretty steep hill. The relations have been very poor over the last couple of years. The president's made some concessions recently, and, everybody can get together and have a nice lunch and sing kumbaya, but ultimately a lot of the regulatory issues and the tax issues that are looming ahead of us are going to keep those relationships very strained in the next year.
All right, Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, the 13th of December. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers section at marketplace.org.
Now to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world?
China says it's going to work to cool down prices on goods in that country. The inflation rate there surged in November. And after an annual economic meeting, the government said it's going to try to bring prices under control. The BBC Shanghai correspondent Chris Hogg is with us now to talk about Chinese inflation and why it risks the global recovery. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
How fast are prices increasing in China?
By more than 5%, and that is way above the government's target of 3%. Inflation in November was at a 28-month high. Now, more than 90% of the increase year-on-year is down to food prices and the costs of utilities at home. Economists here say primarily the weather is to blame for that. But Michael Pettis, professor of finance at Peking University, says it's a real problem for the government.
Inflation is very heavily concentrated in food, and the poor consume a much larger share of their total basket in the form of food rather than the rich. And given the tremendous income inequality in China, that's become a very, very big concern.
So, Chris, what can the government do about it?
It's very difficult. Higher prices in factories, for example, are being driven by higher commodity prices, the prices of metal, cotton. But it's not always clear why these are rising. The suspicion is people are hoarding both commodities and foodstuffs. Apart from clamping down on that, the options are raising interest rates, allowing the yuan, the currency, to appreciate, and tougher rules for banks. But those measures won't help food price inflation, which, as I said, is causing most of the problem at the moment.
And how does Chinese inflation, Chris, affect the rest of the world? Why should we even care about this?
Well, inflation concerns could prompt the Chinese government to allow the currency to appreciate faster. That would make Chinese goods on sale in the U.S. more expensive. But it would also make U.S. exports that compete with Chinese exports more competitive. So there's good news and bad news there. But above all, the world needs a strong Chinese economy, not one weakened by inflation, because China's a growing market for overseas goods.
All right. The BBC's Chris Hogg in Shanghai. Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
The social networking site Twitter is reportedly planning to set up its first European headquarters in London, and the British government is rolling out the red carpet to attract the company to the UK. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The British government has bent over backwards trying to lure Twitter to London. The Prime Minister, David Cameron, entertained Twitter executives in his official residence last week. He's hoping the site will boost a pet project of his, a so-called tech city in the British capital, a mini-rival to Silicon Valley. Twitter won't confirm that it is coming to London, but Rupert Neat, technology correspondent with the Daily Telegraph, has been reading between the tweets of Twitter's head of development.
She tweeted last week about how excited she was to meet the Prime Minister, and she even asked her husband, can we move to London, please? I love it here.
London is one of the top 10 cities for Twitter users, but Prime Minister Cameron isn't one of them. Last year he admitted that he doesn't tweet. The trouble with Twitter, he said, is too many twits. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Jeremy, I know this is something on your to-do list, heading into space.
Oh, yeah, right. Definitely. Yeah,
it's right there, maybe third down. but you don't have the gazillion of dollars, right, to get to space on this private spacecraft.
That is correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
There's now a cheaper option for you, Jeremy.
Oh.
You can send a digital version of yourself, as in a digital photograph.
That doesn't sound like it's quite as much fun.
Well, no. You will not be going to space, but your image will, and that's what's important. Joe Luttrell is trying to finance his space dream by selling these packages for a rocket trip. This rocket will surge 70 miles above the Earth's surface. For $4.95, the Photos to Space package includes a launch image, stats about the rocket that your image will be on, and, of course, a certificate of authenticity. Now, in case you're interested, the space flight is going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $70,000, $80,000. So Luttrell says he needs about 20,000 packages sold to afford the space flight. You know how many he sold so far?
How many?
100. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, December 13th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org.
Well, back to that tax cut package that we've been talking about. It's getting voted on in the Senate today. If it passes both houses of Congress and gets signed into law, all Americans, even the wealthiest, will continue to receive a tax cut. But the plan also includes reestablishment of the estate tax. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan is here to talk about it. Morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
Update us on where we are in the estate tax debate.
Well, where we are is there's legislation pending that would adopt a new set of rules effective the beginning of next year, making estates of $5 million or less tax exempt.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. There's been no inheritance tax or estate tax, if you will, in 2010, right?
That is right. But at the beginning of next year, if nothing happened, the estate tax would come back the way it was in 2000.
And what changes, Alan, after the first of the year?
Okay, the value in the compromise, the Obama-Republican compromise, is a $5 million estate and a tax rate of 35% on everything above that. And that would affect roughly 3,600 estates a year. That's what we're talking about. Whereas had people with that kind of money had the good sense to die in 2010, there would be no estate tax.
How much interest, Alan, do you think people have in this? Does the average Joe really care about estates? I mean, most Americans don't have estates, right?
Well, you see, you know that, and I know that, but most people don't know that because over the years, the estate tax has been changed to the death tax, which makes it sound like it applies to everybody who dies, and it doesn't. It's an example of the triumph of propaganda over reality.
All right. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan this morning. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
We are less than 2 weeks away from Christmas. Sorry, I know that can be a stressful thing to hear when you still have shopping to do, especially if you have to buy something for little kids. Yeah. Steve, do you have any idea what do you get for a two-year-old?
It's limitless.
It's limitless. Well, a growing number of parents say they found a solution. Gift registries for kids. Sally Herships has our story.
I'm in Maplewood, New Jersey, about to hit a party.
Happy birthday to you.
It's for one-year-old Asher Friedland. He has an older sister, so his mom, Danielle, has lots of birthday experience. But this year, she tried something new, registering for gifts for both kids.
My daughter's five. She doesn't tell me that much about her friends.
Friedland says picking out presents for other people's kids can be tough. Registries, she says, are convenient. So, are gift registries for kids tacky, or do they just have a bad rap? Time for another party.
Okay, can I take coats?
Birthday boy David Lavender is 2. His family lives in Brooklyn. While his mom, Nora, cooked lunch for the partygoers, she told me a registry could seem rude, but she likes the idea of being able to suggest presents.
We have limited funds, so the idea of like saying these are the kind of clothes we like has some appeal to it, although I didn't register for him. It's probably the tacky factor. Although I registered for my wedding, so I guess it's not that different.
Or is it? I'm still confused. So I asked Amy Dickinson. She writes the syndicated Ask Amy column.
In my view, the whole idea of registering for gifts for a one-year-old is cuckoo crazy.
Dickinson says a birthday for a young kid should be a family celebration, not a gift grab. And she says parents who register could miss out.
I'm a mother of 5, and I might want to give your one-year-old something that you haven't thought of.
But Asher's mom, Danielle Friedland, says she tried to make her kids' registries thoughtful, and she only gave out information if people asked. Well, at least there's one group who just doesn't care.
What did you get?
Card Spider-Man! Toy Story!
I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, let's end this podcast with a tale from the highest heights of stupidity.
Let's go there.
Well, a store in Canada was broken into and robbed last week, and the owner is very confused. And he's confused because the store is called the Free Store, and everything in it is free.
Okay, so he's not going to press charge?
Maybe not. But customers basically pay $2 to drop off stuff they don't want, and then they can take anything they want for free. The whole point of it is to keep stuff out of the landfill that's right. Unnecessary. Well, luckily, the thieves were caught before they were able to, go over to McDonald's and steal the free ketchup packets, or maybe head over to the local department store and steal the free perfume sandwich. Sample, something like that.
No, I hope not.
Anyway, you see what I was saying about the highest heights of stupidity.
Not the smartest guys. As we call them, we give them the Darwin Awards, right?
The Darwin Award. There you go. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.